All right, buckle up, everybody, because today we're diving deep into the world of Isaiah.
Specifically.
Yeah, specifically this mysterious figure
right.
called the Servant of the Lord. We're working with some fascinating lecture notes, actually.
Oh, cool.
From a seminary class on the major prophets.
Nice.
And they really dig into Isaiah chapters 49 and 50.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's amazing to me how this ancient text still speaks to us even today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, grappling with questions of identity, suffering, hope.
For sure.
In a way that I think resonate with all of us. The real head scratcher is, who is this servant?
Right.
Is it like symbolic of Israel, a future individual?
Yeah.
Or maybe even both?
That's the central question, isn't it? And it's one that's fascinated scholars for centuries. You know,
really?
It's so captivating about these passages is how they weave together personal struggle with this much larger global mission. It's really fascinating.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Isaiah 49 jumps right in with the servant speaking. And it's confusing right from the start.
It is.
Verse 3 calls the servant Israel. But then a few verses later, he's the one who restores Israel. How can that be? Can you be both the problem and the solution?
It's a paradox for sure.
Yeah.
But maybe that's the point.
Okay.
This idea of the servant both coming from and representing Israel.
Mm.
Think of it like a seed.
Okay.
That grows into something much larger than itself.
Like that seed of the woman from Genesis.
Exactly. A descendant of Eve.
Right.
Connected to her lineage, but also representing something much greater.
So are you saying this servant is like a microcosm of Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Embodying the nation, but also pointing to something beyond it.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay.
And there's another detail that emphasizes this unique role.
What's that?
Isaiah 49.1.
Okay.
It focuses on the servant's mother.
Oh, interesting.
You don't see that very often in the Old Testament.
Right.
Where lineage is usually traced through the father. It says, "The Lord called me from the womb. From the body of my mother, he named me."
That does make him sound pretty special.
Right.
Set apart from birth.
Yeah.
And it's not just his origin story that's unusual, right?
Mm-hmm.
This servant is also described as incredibly powerful and effective.
Absolutely.
Right.
Isaiah uses vivid imagery, you know?
Yeah.
A mouth like a sharp sword, a polished arrow.
Wow.
He's divinely equipped, hidden in God's hand for protection.
Yeah.
Clearly meant for great things.
You get this sense of anticipation, like something major is about to unfold.
Yeah.
But then, boom. Isaiah 49.4 hits us with this.
Yeah.
"I have labored to no purpose. I have spent my strength in vain and for nothing." Wait, what? This all-powerful figure faces setbacks.
This verse has sparked a lot of debate.
Really?
Some scholars think it's the nation of Israel expressing its frustration with exile and hardship. Others believe it's the individual servant foreshadowing a future struggle.
Interesting.
What stands out to you?
It's hard to say for sure.
Yeah.
But either way, it is surprising to see this seemingly unstoppable force grappling with what sounds like failure.
Yeah. And yet, even in the face of what seems like defeat, the servant remains steadfast in his faith.
Okay.
He says, "Yet what is due me is in the Lord's hand, and my reward is with my God."
That is a powerful message of trust.
Right.
Even when things don't go as planned.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what obstacles the servant might encounter.
Yeah.
And this isn't just about Israel's internal struggles either, right?
Right.
The servant's mission actually expands beyond their borders.
You're picking up on a crucial point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Isaiah 49.6,
okay.
God tells the servant,
"Yeah,
it is too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles."
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's not just about restoring one nation.
No.
But bringing light to the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big job description.
It is.
Wow.
And it speaks to the universal scope of the servant's mission.
Okay.
Isaiah even mentions people coming from the land of Sinim to follow him.
Oh, wow.
Some scholars believe that could refer to China.
Wow. Talk about global impact.
Right.
It seems like this servant's influence knows no bounds.
Right.
But then we move into Isaiah 50.
Yeah.
And the tone shifts dramatically.
It does.
It feels much more personal, almost like we're getting a glimpse into the servant's inner world.
You're right.
Yeah.
The language becomes more intimate, more emotional. And as you pointed out, the focus shifts to a different aspect of the servant's experience, his suffering.
Okay, so let's dive into that.
All right.
What can you tell us about this shift in Isaiah 50?
Hmm.
what kind of suffering are we talking about here?
Okay.
And what does it mean for the servant's mission?
Well, one of the first things you notice is the servant's claim of obedience in Isaiah 50.5. I have not been rebellious. I have not drawn back. This immediately sets him apart from the nation of Israel.
Right.
Which, if we're being honest, had a bit of a track record of disobedience.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
The lecture notes actually cite a bunch of verses
mm-hmm.
where Israel's rebellion is described. Isaiah 42, 43, 48.
Oh, wow.
There's a clear distinction being made here.
Right.
Yeah.
And that contrast becomes even more stark
yeah.
when you consider the graphic depictions of the servant suffering in Isaiah 50.6.
Okay.
He talks about offering his back to those who beat him.
Oh, wow.
His cheeks to those who pulled out his beard.
Oh, man.
It's a pretty intense image.
It's hard to hear about that kind of suffering.
Yeah.
Especially knowing that it seems to be voluntary.
It is.
What do you think is going on there?
Mm.
Why is the servant willingly enduring this?
That's a question we'll explore in more depth as we move into the later chapters of Isaiah.
Okay.
But for now, it's important to note that this suffering seems to be at the heart of the servant's mission.
Hmm.
It's not something he avoids or tries to escape.
Yeah.
It's something he embraces.
So even though the servant is this unique individual,
mm-hmm.
his suffering seems to be tied to the fate of Israel, maybe even to the fate of humanity as a whole.
That's a really insightful observation.
What?
And it's something we'll see play out in even more powerful ways
okay.
as we continue our deep dive into Isaiah.
Well, listeners, I don't know about you,
yeah,
but I'm hooked.
Me too.
We'll be back in just a moment to dig even deeper into the mystery of the servant of the Lord in Isaiah.
Sounds good.
Stick around. We're back and ready to keep going with this idea of the servant as both an individual,
yeah.
but also a representation of Israel.
It's fascinating.
This tension that runs through Isaiah
yeah.
seems crucial for understanding these prophecies.
Uh-huh.
It's like trying to solve a puzzle where the pieces don't quite fit together.
It is. It's very complex.
Conventionally.
Right.
So where do we go from here?
We've established that the servant isn't just any Israelite.
No.
There's something unique, almost messianic about this figure.
Right. And that's where Isaiah 50 really starts to
okay.
point us towards a specific individual.
Okay.
Jesus.
I was hoping we'd get to the Jesus connection.
Of course.
So what are some of the clues that link the servant to Jesus?
Well, remember that line from Isaiah 50.4 where the servant says, "The sovereign Lord has given me an instructed tongue to know the word that sustains the weary."
Hmm.
It sounds a lot like a preview of Jesus's teaching ministry.
Yeah.
You know, his compassion for those who are hurting and lost.
You know, you're right. Didn't Jesus say something similar in the Gospels?
Yeah.
Something like,
yeah.
"Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest."
Exactly. Matthew 11.28.
Oh, wow.
It's a clear echo of the servant's words in Isaiah.
Yeah.
As though Isaiah is giving us a glimpse, you know, centuries beforehand, of the kind of person Jesus would be.
Mm.
Someone who speaks words of comfort.
Right.
And offers rest to the weary.
It's amazing how these ancient prophecies can resonate so powerfully across time.
It is.
Even though Isaiah was written, you know, long before Jesus lived.
Right.
It's like we're seeing hints of his character and mission foreshadowed in the figure of the servant.
And it goes even deeper than that.
Okay.
Remember how the servant declares, "I have not been rebellious. I have not drawn back."
Right.
That statement really sets him apart.
Yeah.
Especially when you contrast it with Israel's history of disobedience.
Right.
Makes you wonder, you know,
yeah.
who else throughout history could truly claim to have never rebelled against God?
It's a claim that, I mean,
yeah.
only Jesus could make.
Exactly.
It underscores his uniqueness, his sinlessness.
It does.
And ultimately, it's this sinlessness that enables him to take on the suffering that rightfully belongs to others.
Right.
Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like he's stepping in
right.
and taking our place.
Exactly.
That's what makes the servant's voluntary suffering in Isaiah 50.6 so profound.
It is.
Offering his back to those who beat him, his cheeks to those who pulled out his beard.
Tough stuff.
That imagery is hard to stomach.
It is, and it foreshadows the crucifixion of Jesus.
Hmm.
This idea of willingly enduring humiliation and pain for the sake of others.
Yeah.
Isaiah doesn't shy away from the brutality of it all.
No, he doesn't.
It's a stark reminder
yeah.
of the cost of true love and sacrifice.
It really makes you think about the lengths to which God would go to reconcile with humanity.
Yeah.
It's like Isaiah is giving us a sneak peek into the heart of God's plan for redemption. Centuries before it unfolds.
And this brings us to Isaiah 50.7.
Okay.
one of the most crucial verses for understanding the servant's mission and its connection to Jesus.
Okay.
It says, "Therefore have I set my face like flint, and I know that I will not be put to shame."
That line always gives me chills.
Right. There's such a sense of unwavering determination there.
It's the kind of resolve you see in someone who knows what needs to be done,
yeah,
even if it means facing unimaginable suffering.
Exactly. And the lecture notes point out,
yeah,
that this phrase, "set my face like flint,"
yeah,
is echoed in the New Testament.
Really?
When it describes Jesus setting his face to go to Jerusalem,
mm,
knowing full well what awaited him there.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's in Luke 9:51.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subtle but powerful connection that underscores the continuity between Isaiah's prophecy and the life of Jesus.
Right.
Like, Isaiah's painting a portrait of the Messiah, highlighting his obedience, his suffering, and his ultimate triumph.
Absolutely.
But there's still this back and forth in the text,
yeah,
between the servant as an individual and the nation of Israel.
Right.
That's what I find so puzzling.
Yeah.
If the servant is this unique individual, this foreshadowing of Jesus, why is there still this blurring of the lines between him and the nation of Israel?
That's a question that has fascinated scholars for centuries.
Yeah.
And there isn't one easy answer.
Okay.
Some see it as a kind of poetic or literary device. You know, a way to highlight the multifaceted nature of the servant's mission.
Okay.
Others believe it points to a deeper theological truth. Hmm. This idea that the destiny of the individual is intertwined with the destiny of the community.
So it's not just about one person saving the world.
Right.
But about the transformative power of sacrifice and redemption that can impact entire nations.
Precisely.
Wow.
It's a reminder that we're all interconnected, and
yeah,
our choices, our actions, have ripple effects that go far beyond ourselves.
It's incredible how these ancient texts can speak to our modern lives in such a profound way.
I know, it's really amazing.
They challenge us to think about our own roles as servants,
mm-hmm,
to ask ourselves what kind of sacrifices we're willing to make for the sake of others,
mm,
for justice and healing in the world.
Absolutely. It's a deep dive in itself.
Yeah.
But before we get too existential,
right,
let's get back to Isaiah.
Okay.
We've talked about the servant's mission, his suffering, his connection to Jesus.
Okay.
But what about his ultimate fate?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
What happens next?
Yeah.
In this unfolding drama of the servant.
That's where Isaiah 52 and 53 come in.
Okay.
And things get really intense.
Yeah.
We're about to encounter some of the most powerful and profound prophecies in the entire Old Testament.
I'm both excited and a little nervous to hear what's coming next.
Yeah.
What awaits the servant in these chapters?
Mm.
How does his story unfold?
Right.
And what does it mean for us?
Well, buckle up, because we're about to enter the heart of the servant's story, a story that will forever change the course of history. We'll be back in a moment to dive into Isaiah 52 and 53, the climax of the servant songs. Don't go anywhere.
We're back, and I am ready for this intense final act,
right,
of the servant story.
Yeah.
You mentioned Isaiah 52 and 53 are pretty
powerful,
heavy-hitting.
Yeah.
They paint this vivid picture of suffering and sacrifice.
You're absolutely right. Isaiah 53 especially is known as the suffering servant passage.
Mm-hmm.
It's had a huge impact on how both Jewish and Christian traditions understand the Messiah.
The first time I read it, I was honestly,
yeah,
overwhelmed.
Heavy.
By the imagery.
Yeah.
It's not exactly light reading.
No, it's definitely not.
But even though it's hard to confront those images,
right,
there's also like this profound beauty and emotional depth,
mm-hmm,
in these chapters,
yeah,
wrestling with some of the hardest questions.
Absolutely.
About human suffering and the possibility of redemption.
It's a powerful, powerful section.
So let's get into it.
Okay.
What are Isaiah 52 and 53 telling us about the servant's ultimate fate?
Mm.
What does his suffering actually accomplish?
Well, Isaiah 52 starts by offering a message of comfort and restoration for Zion.
Okay.
You get this sense that things are about to turn around,
yeah,
for the people of Israel.
Okay.
But then the focus shifts to this stark and surprising portrait of the servant.
Right.
He's described as being disfigured, despised, utterly rejected.
Yeah. Isaiah 52:12 says, "Just as many were astonished at you, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men."
Mm.
It's a shocking image, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't expect a figure who's supposed to bring hope to be described in such a way.
Right. And it goes even further. The text says that kings will be speechless when they see him.
Wow.
Because his appearance is so unexpected. So different from what they imagined.
This is someone who has suffered deeply.
Absolutely.
Both physically and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like Isaiah's emphasizing the servant's degradation.
Right.
Humiliation. Instead of
glossing over it.
Yeah, why would he do that?
That's the paradox at the heart of these chapters.
Okay.
The servant's suffering isn't just some random event or a side effect of his mission. It's actually the very thing that makes his mission possible.
I'm not sure I follow.
Okay.
How can suffering be redemptive?
Yeah, it's a tough question.
I mean, logically, it seems like the opposite.
I know, that's what Isaiah 53 wrestles with.
Okay.
It begins by describing the servant as a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who was despised and rejected by those he came to save.
And then comes that powerful line. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed.
Hmm.
It's hard to even grasp the depth of what that means.
It's definitely one of the most profound statements in the entire Bible. It suggests that the servant's suffering isn't just about his own pain, but about taking on the sins of others,
right,
the weight of their wrongdoing, in order to make healing and peace possible.
It's like he's a stand-in, absorbing the punishment that we deserve.
Exactly.
Is that what's meant by vicarious suffering?
Yes, precisely.
And that concept goes against everything we usually think about justice and punishment.
It does.
You'd expect the guilty to be the ones who suffer.
Right.
Not the innocent.
Right.
That's what makes the servant so extraordinary. He's described as righteous and blameless, yet he willingly takes on the suffering that belongs to those who have rebelled against God.
Yes, and Isaiah 53 is very clear about that.
Okay.
It says, "All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all."
So even though humanity has chosen to turn away from God, the servant chooses to bear the consequences of that rebellion.
That's powerful.
That's an incredible picture of grace and redemption.
It is.
But why?
Yeah.
Why would the servant choose to do this?
Right.
What could possibly motivate such a costly act of love?
That's the ultimate question, isn't it?
It is.
It's a question theologians have pondered for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, it's a mystery.
Right.
Rooted in the depth of God's love.
Yeah.
For humanity.
Mm.
A love that is willing to go to any lengths.
Wow.
To restore relationship, to heal what's broken.
Really makes you think about your own life, your own choices.
Yeah.
Are you willing to stand up for what's right? Even when it costs you something?
Right.
What kind of sacrifices are you willing to make for the well-being of others?
Those are questions we all need to ask ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think these passages from Isaiah offer a powerful framework for understanding the nature of true love and sacrifice. They remind us that real love isn't just a feeling, it's a choice.
Yeah.
An action.
Right.
A willingness to lay down your own needs and desires for the sake of someone else.
The professor's notes point out something interesting about the language used to describe the servant's suffering.
Okay.
It's not vague or abstract.
No.
It's raw.
It is.
And visceral.
Yeah.
Isaiah uses words like pierced, crushed, and afflicted to convey the intensity of what the servant endures.
Right.
There's no sugarcoating it.
Absolutely not.
It's almost as if he wants us to feel the weight of that sacrifice.
Right.
To understand that redemption comes at a cost.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not cheap or easy.
Yeah.
And maybe by confronting the brutality of it all, we can catch a glimpse of the depth of love that motivates it.
You hit on a really important point.
Mm.
I think that's one of the reasons why Isaiah 53 has had such a profound impact on people throughout history.
Right.
It doesn't shy away from the darkness, from the difficult questions.
Yeah.
But it also offers this glimpse of something truly transformative.
Mm.
Something that can heal and redeem even the most broken parts of ourselves.
Yeah.
And the world around us.
I think we've done a pretty thorough deep dive.
I agree.
Into the servant of the Lord in Isaiah.
Yeah.
We've explored his mission, his suffering, his connection to Jesus.
Right.
And the hope he offers to both Israel and the entire world.
That's right.
And honestly, it's left me with a lot to think about.
It has for me too.
What about you?
Yeah, definitely.
What stands out to you the most?
I think just the magnitude of the sacrifice, you know, and what it means for us today.
Yeah, it's something to ponder for sure.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's our takeaway for today.
Yeah.
As you continue to explore these passages from Isaiah.
Right.
Let them challenge you, comfort you,
mm-hmm.
and inspire you to live a life of purpose and meaning.
I love that.
A life that embraces both the struggles
mm-hmm.
and the joys of being human.
Yeah.
A life that reflects the radical love and sacrifice we've encountered.
Right.
In the story of the servant.
Beautifully said.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Until next time, keep seeking.
Keep questioning.
Keep diving deep.